Thank you very much, Surya Gupta. And this series of rambles is dedicated to you. Many of you will know that Surya Gupta has been the chair of the LBC for 24 hours. And she's made a pretty good job of it so far. But partly I've been reflecting on these issues anyway, but I've been thinking about government, governance, leadership, and so forth. And I've been reflecting on what the Dhamma has to say about that. So tonight I'm mainly going to give you a little bit of an idea of what the Buddha himself had to say about government. And tomorrow night I hope to look a little bit more about what that means in a democratic context. And then the final night I want to look at what bearing this has on us as members of a Buddhist Sangha, or as people interested in a Buddhist Sangha. That's at least what I'm thinking at the moment. We'll see what happens when I actually start speaking. I've just come back from India, and I must admit my brain isn't quite at full cylinder yet, so we'll see whether I can manage or not. I usually pull something off. Obviously, like many people, I've been really sort of concerned and partly also interested in the current political situation. We seem to be going through one of those big phases of change and uncertainty, where it really isn't very clear what is happening, especially in democratic countries. The rise of populist nationalism is very striking in many countries. Britain's relatively mild in that respect, but it's affected us here too. But I work in Hungary, where populist nationalism is extreme. And because I'm mainly involved with people, gypsies, Roma, who constitute about 6% of the population, they feel very sharply the rise of this nationalism because it excludes them. They don't consider themselves to be part of the same nation, so to speak, even though they have the same passport, if they have one at all. I've seen similar things in India, and of course we're very familiar with what's happening in many other countries in Europe and worldwide. This swing towards a populist nationalism and the collapse of the old ideological certainties, or at least clarities. And I've been considering, discussing with my friends, especially in India, what bearing the Dhamma has upon this situation. Because it seems to me, to some extent, the rise of populist nationalism, especially within democratic countries, represents the limitations of the liberal ideal and the failure to find a deep rooting for that ideal. So I've, of course, been working in India with followers of Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, Bhimrao Ramji Ambedkar, who is one of the foremost figures in modern Buddhism. He was born into an untouchable community at that time. That's all you could call it, a community that was at the bottom of the caste system and was considered to pollute caste Hindus, constitutes about 15-16% of the population. And they still suffer from major disability and exclusion. But Dr. Ambedkar in 1956 converted to Buddhism as a way of escaping the caste system, because the caste system is embedded in the old religion, and a way of people claiming their dignity as human beings was to leave that old religion. But he believed that religion was necessary to humanity. There had to be a higher ideal. And he found in Buddhism the ideal that he thought satisfied those needs. The movement of conversion that he initiated, with which Sangharakshita became involved, as you've heard from Surya Gupta, probably now includes some 30, 40, 50 million people in India, which is a very small fraction of the population, but it's still a sizable number. And they've changed their economic and social situation unimaginably. I've just been giving a series of talks at a festival, a Buddha festival in Nagpur, at the place where Dr. Ambedkar converted with 400,000 of his followers. And when he converted, they would have been in rags. He asked them to come in white, and many of them had to borrow money in order to buy white clothes to come. They were the poorest, mostly completely illiterate, mainly bonded labourers, i.e. slaves, and out of their deep gratitude to and faith in Dr. Ambedkar, they came in their droves and they converted. So I was talking to an audience of middle-class Indians, well-dressed, with good jobs, doctors, lawyers, business people, and so on, all of whom were the grandchildren of the people who had converted in 1956. So I could see with my own eyes, I could imagine their ancestors just sitting there in their rags with their innocence and their poverty and their ignorance, and at least in the educational sense. And now these their sons and daughters and grandchildren and great-grandchildren sitting with good lives, good houses, good jobs, largely because as a result of declaring themselves to be Buddhists, they'd gained a sense of dignity and of self-responsibility. So one's very aware through Dr. Ambedkar of the potential social and even political impact of Buddhism. But India is not a Buddhist country. It was, or at least there are a substantial number of Buddhists 1,500 years ago. But Buddhism died out in the late Middle Ages in India for interesting reasons. It was fairly systematically suppressed. There's a strong movement of Hindu nationalism, right-wing Hindu nationalism, which is of a piece with the populist nationalism that we're seeing in Europe, in Russia, in Turkey, and so on. So when one sees these movements and sees them from the perspective of those who suffer from the populist nationalism, you feel we must think very deeply about the role of government and our responsibility as citizens in relation to government, and to consider, well, what the ideal might be for government, what therefore we as citizens need to be working towards in relation to government, what we need to do using our modicum of power to move things in the right direction. So it's this that I want to begin to address. My thoughts are by no means complete. And as I say, I'm not at my most mentally efficient at the moment. I'll do my best. But quite a lot I want to say. I'm not sure whether I'll be able to say it all. While I was in India, I gave a series of talks at this Buddha festival, about 5,000 people, it's quite a small audience. And I was asked to speak on the subject of Pratitya Samutpada, conditioned co-production, dependent arising. I had four talks to give. And I brought out on the third talk the fact that in the center of the Indian flag is a Dhamma chakra, a Dhamma wheel, which is very, very significant. If anybody's seen the Indian flag, there's an orange strip at the top representing Hinduism, the green strip at the bottom representing Islam, white strip in the middle representing everybody else, and a blue Dhamma chakra in the middle. That is there at Dr. Ambedkar's suggestion. He was on the on the committee that designed the national flag. The original idea from Congress, from Nehru and Gandhi, Mr. Gandhi, was to have a charkha, a cotton spinning wheel, which was Gandhi's great symbol of self-reliance and independence of the cotton mills of Manchester and so forth. But it was thought this was not a good symbol for a flag because it's asymmetrical and a bit fiddly. And Dr. Ambedkar sneakily suggested the Dharmachakra, nice, neat, symmetrical symbol. And of course, that Dharmachakra is 24 spokes, it has, is connected with the Emperor Ashoka, who is really the embodiment of the Buddhist ideal of kingship, which we'll come back to in a minute. So the Ashok Chakra, that's what it's called. It's also on the crest of the Republic of India, again at Dr. Ambedkar's suggestion. The Ashok Chakra is based upon a stone carving that was discovered at Sarnath, where the Buddha first taught. And it stood on top of a pillar, a large pillar, with four lions facing in four directions, famous lion pillar. And the wheel was on top of that. You never see that because it fell off fairly obviously. But its fragments have been found. The lion capital is intact and it's been re-erected, but the Dharmachakra itself fell off and shattered. But it should have been a pillar, a large pillar, with four lions, rather fine lions, facing the four directions, with a big wheel sitting on top. And it's on that wheel of the fragments that the wheel in the centre of the Indian flag is based. Now, this is enormously significant, far more significant than I'm sure the flag committee would have realised. I'm sure Dr. Ambedkar would have been very well aware. But the ancient Indian tradition was, rather the ancient Magadhan tradition, I'll come back to that in a moment, was that when a king ruled righteously, a wheel would appear in the sky above his palace. As a sort of symbol of his righteousness. It's very, very interesting and lots that could be said about it. But I want to say a little bit about the background in Magadhan culture, because the Buddha, as you probably know, was born in Lumbini, gained enlightenment at Bodh Gaya, which is in modern Bihar, and taught in Bihar, what is now the state of UP, Madhya Pradesh, and a little bit in Bengal, even down into Orissa. So eastern, northern India. He wandered all over, wandered even as far as Delhi. We've got records of him in the Delhi area. And the culture in that area was quite different from the Brahminical Vedic culture in the area of Punjab, Haryana, Delhi, and the Ganges basin. Quite a different culture. It was not Brahminical, in other words, no priestly caste. There was a very limited caste system. We don't know much about this culture of Magadha, but it was a very different background in which the Buddha started to teach. And Mahavira, the Jain Tathankara, the founder of Jainism, or at least the historical founder of Jainism, was from that same area and appears in the Buddhist scriptures. And a number of other Shramanic traditions, wanderer traditions, were in that area. And many of the features of modern Indian culture originated there in Buddhism, Jainism, Ajivikas, and other such religions. But at the time of the Buddha, the Brahminical Vedic culture was pushing into this area. And in the Buddhist scriptures, you see a sort of confrontation between the Brahminical Vedic culture, which was mainly based on the idea of the sacrifice, the manipulation of divine forces through the sacrifice. And the Buddha was directly confronting that incursion from the Brahminical area. Very interesting. The very first encounter he had after his enlightenment is a favourite incident of in my stories. After enlightenment, he spent several weeks at in the area where he gained enlightenment, sitting under various trees, which is interesting in itself. But he sat under a particular tree, and there a Brahmin came to visit him and said, "What makes one a Brahmin?" And, you know, the big question at the time, because the Brahmins are trying to establish their power and dominance in the Magadhan area. So the Buddha just flatly rejects a hierarchical notion of social worth. Completely, bluntly, flatly rejects it. It's not your birth that determines your status and value. What determines your status and value is your moral quality, your understanding, even your spiritual insight. So the Buddha is sort of at war with this imposition of a hierarchical social order. No doubt it had its own hierarchies at the time, but they would be less rigid and less religiously based, less ideologically based. There are always hierarchies, but the caste system is a particularly hard and rigid imposition of hierarchy. So the Buddha completely, flatly rejected it. At the same time, what was happening in that area was the tribal system was beginning to break down. In the area of North India where the Buddha grew up, particularly Lumbini, where he was born, in the Terai on the border of Nepal, well, it's in Nepal now, was dominated by small tribal communities. The Shakyas were a tribe. And not a caste, a tribe, if you see what I mean. People sharing a common ancestry with a common identity. And they were broadly Republican. In other words, a male oligarchy, if you see what I mean. And they had elected leaders. It said that the Buddha's own father was not a king, but the elected leader. There's no evidence for that at all. The Buddha doesn't say that. But this is pious addition later. But these small Republican tribes were gradually being eaten up by monarchies, particularly in that area, the monarchy of Magadha, which is based on Patna, and the monarchy of Kosala, which is a bit further north. These two were in conflict in the scriptures. You see it going on. So you see this process of these new monarchies with new economic methods. Magadha had huge quantities of iron which had been discovered, so they were getting into smelting iron and making weapons and using it for trade and so forth. So there was a huge economic surplus which fueled imperial growth and a gradual eating up of these small republican tribes, which eventually led to the Mauryan Empire, which constituted what is now the whole of the Republic of India, except for the southern tip, Afghanistan, a bit of Persia, Pakistan, Bangladesh, quite a lot of territory. But it all began with this process of eating up these small republican tribes. So the Buddha lived an extremely interesting time, a time of massive change, when there was a gradual imposition of a hierarchical system, caste system, which was solidifying, and where the Brahmins were claiming the top place, and an expansion of the monarchies, the kingdoms. The Buddha himself was the familiar of the two main kings, Bimbisara and Ajatasattu. He knew them personally, and they honoured him, Pasenadi. They honoured him, they took him as their teacher, and he had some influence upon them, even to some extent a restraining influence. And he had an influence in stiffening the backbone of some of these small republican tribes. So I give you all that by way of a little bit of background. It's not particularly relevant, but to what I'm going to say. But it is interesting that the Buddha was living at a time when politics and society, the structure of society, the structure of government, were in massive transition. By and large, the Buddha's influence is entirely moral. What he's constantly stressing is the morality of the rulers. We'll come on to that in a little bit. But in the midst of all this change, there gradually was growing up, and I don't think you find it outside Buddhism, but you find it growing in Buddhism, of the idea of the righteous king, the Dhamma Raja, or the Chakrapravartan Raja, the wheel-turning king, the king who turns the wheel of justice, the wheel of truth, ultimately the wheel of Dharma. So the myth is found in the scriptures, in the Digha Nikaya particularly. There are two suttas which go into this, one called the Chakravartin Raja Sihanada Sutta, the lion's roar of the wheel-turning monarch. And it talks in mythic terms about a king who ruled righteously. We'll see what that means in a moment. And eventually this wheel appeared in the sky above his palace, indicating his righteousness. And he ruled righteously. He, as we'll see, he looked after his people. He lived a moral life. He venerated the Dhamma. At a certain point, the wheel began to disappear. And he consulted his counselors, and they said that this indicates it's time for you to abdicate. Interesting. It's time for you to go into the forest. Like Jnanavacha, going off into the forest. So off he went. And before he went, he instructed his son. He said, that Dhammachakra will not come back. It's not an inheritance. I can't give it to you. You have to create it, so to speak. And this is how you do it. We'll see how in a moment. You need to rule righteously. And when you rule righteously, that Dhammachakra will appear. So the new king did rule righteously, and everything went wonderfully. Eventually, he went off into the forest. His son took over, and so it went until one thought he wouldn't bother with ruling according to the Dhamma. He would rule according to his own ideas. That's what it says. Rule according to his own ideas. You know how things go wrong when you do rule according to your own ideas. And what happened was he neglected some of the key things that his ancestor had said you need to do if the Dhammachakra is to persist. And so that meant that the guilty went unpunished. That meant that, the first thing that happened was that people fell into poverty, which is very interesting. People fell into poverty, and because people fell into poverty, some then started to steal. And because some started to steal, the king undertook punishment, capital punishment. And because the king undertook capital punishment, that meant people generally took up weapons and started enforcing the law themselves, as it were. And so you got social anarchy. And very interestingly, the span of life got shorter and shorter until I think it was down to about 10 days. So you've got a sort of political theory mixed in the form of a myth, but there's some quite clear lines in what is being said. And I'll come on shortly to describe what the sutta says a Chakravartin Raja should do, a wheel-turning monarch should do, in order for that wheel to continue to turn in the sky. But before I do that, I want to mention another sutta that comes before that, which is called the Aganya Sutta, which is, means the Sutta of Origins, where things come from. And this is a sort of, you couldn't say a Buddhist creation myth, it's more like a Buddhist recreation myth, because in Buddhism there's no first beginning. But the traditional Buddhist cosmology, and take it as myth rather than as anything else, teaches that there's a continuous process of coming into being and destruction of world systems. So the whole world system gradually unfolds and achieves its final flowering and then gradually dissolves. And at the dissolution, sort of spirit and matter become completely separate. You get sort of absolutely pure mind and absolutely pure matter. Not self-conscious mind, if you see what I mean, but rarefied spirit. The very sort of essence of matter. There's complete darkness and water. Beings have, there's only beings. There's neither male nor female, nor this animal nor that animal. But gradually it all comes back into form. First of all, it's delightful. A nutritious scum forms on the surface of the waters. And as one of the beings one day puts down, I don't know whether they had hands, but anyway, tastes some of this scum and says, delicious. And gradually they all start partaking of this scum. But of course, the consequence is they take on a more gross reality, if you see what I mean. And they lose gradually, progressively, their luminescence. And, they then gradually, you know, become this sexual dimorphism emerges, and the rest is history. Well, literally, the rest is history. And what then happens is that they, to begin with, everything you need just appears spontaneously. It's a sort of, the state of nature. It's that myth that you get in European culture, the state of nature, Adam and Eve and all that. And they gradually, somebody realizes that instead of just going to the field and picking what you could do is pick enough for tomorrow and keep it. And then you realize, well, actually, I could pick enough for a week and just, you know, chill for the rest of the time and then go out and do it again. You see, the same old habits. And of course, sooner or later, somebody realizes that I don't even have to go and pick for 7 days or a week or a month or whatever. What I can do is go and nick his. And so, so slowly social anarchy emerges. What then happens is that they realize that they're not able to order society. It doesn't order itself naturally. And they decide that they're going to elect, appoint somebody to do the punishing and rewarding for them. And so they elect the chosen of the people, whose job is simply to carry out preservation of law and order. So it's a social contract theory, if you like. It's rather like Hobbes, actually, for those of you who studied political history, which I've studied a bit. The state of nature, nasty, brutish, and short. And it is getting shortish and shorter in the myth. So the idea of kingship is conceived in the Buddhist context as a contract. The king is appointed by the consent of the people in order to maintain law and order because they can't do it themselves. Which again is quite interesting, and we'll be reflecting a bit more on this tomorrow. So I'm merely reporting all this, by the way. I just think it's useful to know what the tradition says, at least in this sort of mythic area, because there's truths within it. But where it gets particularly interesting is where the king, the first of the Chakravartin Rajas, speaks to his son before he goes off into the forest, and he gives him instructions as to how to rule. So the crown prince says, "But what, sire, is the duty of an Aryan wheel-turning monarch? It is this, my son. Yourself depending on the Dhamma, honouring it, revering it, cherishing it, doing homage to it and venerating it, having the Dhamma as your badge and banner, acknowledging the Dhamma as your master, you should establish guard, ward and protection according to Dhamma for your own household, your troops, your nobles and vassals, for Brahmins and householders, town and country folk, ascetics and Brahmins, for beasts and birds. Let no crime prevail in your kingdom, and to those who are in need, give property. And whatever ascetics and Brahmins, Shramanas and Brahmanas, in your kingdom have renounced the life of sensual infatuation and are devoted to forbearance and gentleness, each one taming himself, each one calming himself, and each one striving for the end of craving, from time to time you should go to them and consult them as to what is wholesome and what is unwholesome, that is blameworthy and what is blameless, what is to be followed and what is not to be followed, and what action will in the long run lead to harm and sorrow, and what to welfare and happiness. Having listened to them, you should avoid evil and do what is good. That, my son, is the duty of an Aryan wheel-turning monarch." Of course, we can a little bit jump ahead to the next few nights, but this is really what we should be demanding of our politicians. Seriously. So let's just go through that a little bit more carefully. I'll deal with this again in another context. Yourself depending on the Dhamma, honouring it, revering it, cherishing it, doing homage to it and venerating it. So what is the Dhamma? Of course, it's the Buddhist teaching. But here, that's not what's meant. What's meant is the ultimate moral law. It means the ideal of virtues, the virtues of human existence. It means the higher ideals that should guarantee a good human society. So the king, the government, the minister or whatever, can only be successful if he or she venerates ideals that go beyond the personal, that go beyond the even sectional, not just our ideals, not even our national ideals, which I think is one of the problems with creeping nationalism, the touchstone of what is good is what is good for blankety blankety blank. Make blankety blankety blank great. Fill in according to taste or not taste. So in the Buddhist idea of the wheel-turning monarch, that is the government that is in accordance with the highest human ideals, there must be a dependence upon those ideals, an honouring of them, a revering of them, a sense that they go beyond oneself, that they are greater than oneself, that one must give oneself to their service, cherishing them, so going out of your way to care for them and make sure they are preserved, not compromising them, doing homage to them, venerating them, having the Dhamma as your badge and banner. Now you see why Dr. Ambedkar was so clever in putting that in the centre of the Indian flag. He made India have the badge and banner of the Dhamma, whether it wanted it or not. In my talks at the Buddha Festival, I said I would try to get one at the centre of the Union Jack. Don't think it'll quite work, but we'll try. Anyway, got a big clap and cheer. So that's the first principle that the government should follow. It should look to values that go beyond the individual, values that even go beyond the particular nation which is to be governed. Not that the values of that nation, the cultural values of that nation, should be neglected, but something beyond them should be honoured. Of course, from a Buddhist point of view, those are moral values, and they're spiritual values in the sense of they depend upon a higher realization, which is beyond ordinary human experience. Then you should establish guard, ward, and protection according to Dhamma for your own household, etc., for everybody, including beasts and birds. So you should create a system of law and order that provides protection for everybody. This is all very much the background to the Emperor Ashoka's life and to the edicts that he promulgated, which I'm surprised to find people don't know much about Ashoka, but I'll say more a bit about him in a bit later. He lived about 250 years after the Buddha and tried to rule India according to these principles, very, very consciously. That's why he set up the Dhamma Chakra on the Lion Capital at Sarnath. Yes, the Dhamma Chakra Pravartin Raja lets no crime prevail in his kingdom and is not afraid to punish when necessary, but at the same time recognizing that crime often emerges from poverty, from need. I'm very aware of this in Hungary because in the gypsy settlements where our friends have been working, our Dhamma Mitras have been working, most of the male population is in jail. Why are they in jail? Because they don't have anything. So, you know, in order to survive, they steal. And for instance, the main village where we work, there's about 3,000 people in the village. The gypsies are slightly under a majority, just about 1,200, 1,300. Mind you, of those, two-thirds are children, so watch out, next generation. But there are 24 police for a population of 3,000, and they're not there for the white Hungarians. Right in the early suttas, again and again, the Buddha recognizes that at least much of crime emerges out of inequality and poverty, which is something quite important for us in considering a Buddhist intervention in government. Need breeds social disharmony, because you see people have when you don't have enough, and in a way I think I could say if I didn't have enough, after some time I'd feel justified in taking, and maybe I would be. So the Buddhist ideal of kingship it very much includes making sure that everybody has enough, and it's one of the functions of the king to give from his own store to provide for all. In one of the later instructions to Dhamma Chakra Pravartin Raja, he's supposed to provide land to the landless and capital to business people so that they can promote trade. Rather interesting. The king is supposed to honour those who take up a religious life. And it's stressed again and again that the formula that's used is Shramana Brahmana. So there were two broad religious strains in ancient India. The first was the Brahmanic strain, which was the priestly caste, hereditary priesthood, who were empowered to perform the sacrificial yajñas, the sacrifices which would guarantee prosperity. So it's a magical conception of the priestly function in order to keep things going well. The other religious system, which prevailed largely in Magadha and from which Buddhism emerged, was the Shramanic, which was based around the idea of renunciation and the personal quest for truth. And the formation of sanghas, of renunciants. So you had the priests, the brahmanas, and the shramanas. So quite different ideas about what is the ideal life, the ideal religious life. But the Buddha stresses again and again honouring both. When it comes to Emperor Ashoka, he appoints religious ministers, I mean ministers of state, who are there to look after the welfare of those who take up a religious life. I think in our own context, one would include maybe those who take up an artistic life, which is, as it were, our own addition to the Brahmana-Shramana sort of lineup. So those who take up the quest for an artistic values would find their place, I think, in this sort of system. So the Ashoka sends out his, what are they called? Dhamma mantris, I think they're called, who are instructed, and we have the edicts, which, you know, spell out their duties. Their duties are to seek out all those leading a spiritual life from whatever persuasion, whatever doctrine they're following, so long as their doctrine does not preach violence or harm, they are to be supported. Even though the Emperor Ashoka was a firm Buddhist, and that's completely clear from the edicts, he believed in a pluralistic society. But he believed in a pluralistic society in which there was a common agreement on a moral basis, if you see what I mean, a shared moral basis. It's a very, very important point. So the duty of the monarch is to support those trying to lead a higher renunciant life in one way or another, to make sure they have support, to make sure they're honoured, and himself, or presumably one would say herself, to consult with them about what is the good life. Because the monarch often is so tied up with the business of life, it's difficult to know what the Dhamma is. So the monarch consults with those who are leading a full-time religious life to try and establish a moral basis and to check actions against that. Very, very significant indeed. Very important point that I think is little noticed. I mentioned the great Dr. Ambedkar, who was initially a statesman and politician even, and was inducted into the first cabinet of independent India as the law minister, and in fact formed the labour laws that are still the basis of Indian employment rules. But he was later asked to become the law minister, and he was asked to chair the committee that was framing the new constitution of the Republic of India. And he considered that the constitution formed what he called a basis of constitutional morality. It's a very interesting conception. So a morality that it's expected that everybody will accept. The constitution defines the duties of citizens, the rights of citizens, and the basis for their constitutional systems, how they elect their government, and so on, and the basis for the legal system, how laws are to be finally judged through the Supreme Court, and so on. But he considered this to establish what he called constitutional morality. Constitutional morality is the basic minimum morality that everybody must accept in order to live in the society, from whatever religion they come. If your religion does not accept constitutional morality, in a sense, it has no place in that society. There can only be a common society where everybody accepts this common minimum morality. Do you see what I mean? And it's this that the Dhammacakra Pravartin Raja, the wheel-turning monarch, defines. So Dr. Ambedkar, to some extent, fulfilled that role for modern India, because India still is the largest democracy in the world and in many ways one of the most successful democracies in the world, with no serious interruptions to its democratic life since independence 65 years ago. Because it's established these common minimum standards, moral standards. As Buddhists, it's important that we do not expect everybody in society to be Buddhists. We seek to try to persuade as many as possible to be Buddhists, but we do not expect of the government to be a Buddhist government. But we expect government to adhere to moral principles that we as Buddhists completely affirm, and that we expect all other religions to be able to accept. If a religion cannot accept this common minimum morality, it cannot exist in a common society. Do you see what I mean? It's fairly obvious what that implies. So the Dhammacakra Pravartin Raja's duty is to uphold the moral law as all human beings can adhere to it. The human moral law, not the Buddhist moral law. Of course, as Buddhists, what we believe is morality is not Buddhist, but it's natural. It's part of the nature of things. So we believe that in Buddhism there's a clear adumbration of moral principles, which probably pretty adequately define what the common minimum is. But we don't expect that to be adhered to as Buddhists by others. But we do expect that anybody living in this society, whether they're Christian, Jew, Muslim, nothing, adheres to that same basic moral principle. That's the essential nature of a pluralistic society. A pluralistic society does not mean mere moral relativism. It means a shared moral basis. Albeit understood in different ways, from different perspectives, underpinned in different ways, having different higher objectives and so forth. But the minimum, the common minimum, is shared. So beginning to get some idea of from looking at the Chakra Pravartin Raja, of what a Buddhist government might imply. Implies a reverence for something that is more than personal. Government should not be carried out in personal interest or sectional interest. It shouldn't even be carried out in merely national interest. Of course, it has to be in national interest because the nation is part of human society as a whole. But it should not be carried out in the interests of the nation at the expense of the humanity as a whole. So that the moral principles should go beyond mere national interests, and insofar as they do go beyond mere national interests, they will also suit national interests. Do you see what I mean? But it's the supervenience of the moral principle that makes it fit national interest rather than the national interest that fits the national interest that is what you adhere to. Jet lag. that's the first and perhaps most essential point, because from that everything else flows. The Raja, the king, the government, needs a reference point outside themselves. So they refer to those who are trying to live out that ideal in its purity. And that is what the Sangha is supposed to do. The Sangha is supposed to be a sort of pure attempt to live out the highest moral principles. So it becomes a reference point for those who are trying to apply those principles within the wider society. The initial function of the Raja, the king, from the point of view of the foundation myth, is as the one who guarantees the social contract, who agrees to enforce law and order impartially. On the basis of the Dhamma, that's very important, that's made quite clear, on the basis of moral principle, not of mere personal interest or prejudice or predisposition. This has gone into much more. We'll have to look a bit at this tomorrow. But is prepared to punish. This is quite an important point is made, although punishment should be proportional and not cruel. Ashoka, in one of his rock edicts, abolishes torture and abolishes capital punishment. This was 300 BC, which is pretty unusual. Sets up ministers to see whether his governors in various provinces are carrying out the edicts, and they're to report back to him. And any subject who is disappointed can appeal to him. In the rock edicts, Ashoka tells how he has established safe roadways with police guarding the roads, with rest houses, with trees to shade the roads. He spells out in detail what he's done, and if he's done a quarter of it, he's done very, very well. He establishes hospitals and hospitals for animals. 300 BC. He says that formerly, when I was first a king, sacrifices were made, many hundreds of thousands of animals died, I have given that up. That will happen no more. And he abolishes animal sacrifice throughout his kingdom. 300 BC. All in pursuit of this ideal of kingship. Kingship as service. In the scriptures, it's obvious that initially Chakravartin Raja is almost equivalent to the Buddha. And in fact, it's said, you remember the myth of the sage Asita, who is shown the young boy and is asked to prognosticate, and says that either he will be a Chakravartin Raja or he will be a Buddha. So the ideal of the Chakravartin Raja is placed pretty high. It's not as high as the Buddha, because the Buddha makes the final transcendence. But the Chakravartin Raja, as the one who functions within the world on the basis of the Dhamma, is placed very high. There's a sutta I was looking at yesterday in which it's one of those twos in the Anguttara Nikaya, which says, there are two most worthy beings who are supreme, the Chakravartin Raja and the Buddha, other than whom no one is superior. So the Chakravartin Raja, the one who rules righteously on the basis of the Dhamma for the benefit of all the people, with their safety and welfare at heart is a very high and central ideal of Buddhism, which I believe needs more investigation and unpacking. It's obviously a very lofty ideal indeed, and often became merely nominal. So many Buddhist kings would speak of themselves as Chakravartin Rajas. I remember Sangharakshita told me that he'd once published in a magazine a strong sort of criticism of the Maharaja of Sikkim, who's a personal friend, who at his son's wedding had, killed hecatombs of animals for the feast. And he sort of said, you call yourself a Chakravartin Raja, and yet this is what you do. So it became increasingly a bit like the notion of the divine right of kings, that the Lord's anointed. There is a majesty that so surrounds a king, and so on. The idea that the king is inviolate because he's been anointed with the holy charism, and that's what happens in the coronation ceremony. It's magic. The queen is turned into a magical being. It happens before your very eyes. Well, actually, behind a curtain. But it's an ancient mystery. Wonderful. But it becomes then pretty nominal, and it merely becomes, do what I say because I'm divine, which is very convenient. And later kingship in Southeast Asia, Cambodia, you get this, the king becomes identified with Avalokiteshvara. So at Angkor Wat, you can see statues of various kings. I don't know their names, but they're identified as incarnations of Avalokiteshvara. So very easily, of course, because politics corrupts so easily. All power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So it the ideal, what is meant to be an ideal, very easily becomes merely a whitewashing of personal interest and prejudice. But this ideal is still considered important. You noticed recently the king of Thailand died, Bhumibol, who is very highly revered by most Taiwanese, Thais, and he was revered as a Chakravartin Raja. Whether he lived up to that ideal is a matter for debate, and don't debate it in Thailand because it's lèse majesté and you can be arrested for it, which gives the game away, doesn't it? But if you have to lock people up when they criticise you, you're clearly not very secure. But I hope you've got at least some idea in my rather rambling and rough and ready way of this ideal of kingship as it's found in early Buddhism. And you can begin to see some of its potential resonance for what government means. Yea, even down in Westminster. Perhaps for the chair of the LBC. But I'd probably better finish on that note and hurry out of the room. But thank you very much.